Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. More and more people are doing the hustle, not the health hustle from the, 70s and 80s, the side hustle. But why? A recent survey from Interact takes a look at why more Canadians are starting their own businesses and becoming entrepreneurs. They also created a learning hub to help Canadians gain the necessary knowledge and tools to grow their business. Anurag Kaur from Interact is here to talk about the survey results and about some of the resources available to entrepreneurs. Before you get started on that side hustle, though, or attempt to launch the next Instagram or TikTok or Shopify, you kind of need an idea. That's one of the topics that our guests today tackle in their book. Catalina Daniels and James Sherman are two startup company founders and angel investors, and they wrote a book sharing the advice of 18 Harvard Business School founders. It's called Smart Startups, and they'll talk about what they learned. Then, how does your behavior impact your financial decision-making? Money expert Jessica Morehouse is here to tell us about some of these behaviors and how they may be holding you back from financial success. Plus, an online platform that lets you use a credit card to pay your rent. It's called Checksy. CEO Liza Akvledziani tells us how it works. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. So you've got this idea. It is a great idea. You love your business idea and you're super jazzed about it, but you might not really be clear on how to bring that idea to fruition. What better way than to learn from those who have already gone through the journey of starting and scaling and maybe even selling their own company? Two startup founders and angel investors, Catalina Daniels and James Sherman, interviewed a whole bunch of founders to share their advice. They wrote a book about it. It is called Smart Startups, What Every Entrepreneur Needs to Know, advice from 18 Harvard Business School founders. They join us now from New York City. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hi, Bruce.
Harvard Business School is a storied institution, but I would say it's better known for churning out Goldman investment bankers and McKinsey consultants than startup success stories. Why did you decide to go fishing in this particular pond?
Thank you for that question, Bruce. But the question used to be known for leadership and top-notch jobs at Goldman and McKinsey and so forth. That was back in the 90s. By now, it's really known for entrepreneurship. And if you look at the stats, Harvard Business School has the most founders with unicorns of all business schools in the US. That is in absolute terms. If you would look at it in relative terms, Stanford still has somewhat of an edge, but Harvard Business School is a bigger school. So in absolute numbers, it's a school that's pretty known.
I love that you're weaving the quant into it. I love that you're weaving the quant into it. Jim, how did you choose the interviewees? Was everyone a home run entrepreneur, or did you sprinkle in a few with humiliating flameouts just to make it interesting?
Well, I would not characterize any as humiliating flare-outs, but we definitely have a wide breadth. So we have those that achieved unicorn status, like Rent the Runway and Gilt and Blue Apron. So a couple that went public, a number that were sold for hundreds of millions of dollars. But we also had those that did not succeed. They either had a fire sale or they were forced to shut down. We've had some that are continuing to operate and doing well enough, but have not exited yet. So we really had all different types of exits, some that did not, some that had huge success, some you would characterize, okay, not really successful, at least as far as the investors are concerned. But back to your other question earlier, I want to point out, believe it or not, 50% of HBS grads do become entrepreneurs within 20 years of graduation. So there's a very high percentage
right.
that go
they may
into
have
this,
earned their stripes in the grind at one of the sweatshops, but then decided to go out and do something to build something.
Exactly. Yes.
Okay. So there are many different definitions of what an entrepreneur actually is. What's one that resonated with you the most?
I think what resonates the most is all of these entrepreneurs had passion to create something. That is fundamental. You have to have the passion to want to create something new, innovative, have control over your life. Clearly, this is a key driver. You also need resilience as an entrepreneur. That's a very important ingredient. And the other third one, which was very interesting when we spoke to the entrepreneurs, is knowing when to jump, knowing when you're going to actually make that jump into this, what can be a bit of a scary proposition if you're leaving a very safe job. So these ingredients are super important, and it's really what you need in order to be to venture off into becoming an entrepreneur. And some are born that way with these ingredients, but one of the surprising lessons is that you don't have to be born with them. You certainly can learn these qualities.
Well, let's continue on with that theme, because in your introduction, you talk about how many of the interviews destroyed preconceived notions of entrepreneurship. Can you give me some other examples?
Other examples, yeah. I was thinking, so born an entrepreneur is a preconceived notion. As Jim said, it doesn't need to be that way. Another example is, as an angel investor or in the VC world or whatever, there is this preconceived notion that there is an ideal team to start a venture. And that is two or three co-founders, equal co-founders, one of which being the CEO and then typically the CTO. And if you have a third one, a chief marketing officer or a chief operating officer, depending on the business you wanna build. Our interviews entirely busted that. So what we got out of our interviews is find the team that's right for you, because we had solo founders. We had teams of five people recruited by a headhunter. We had a mom and her son. We had best friends. We had a married couple. You just name it. And so we have this entire chapter about find the right team for yourself. What fits for yourself? Do you want to go solo? Do you want to go with somebody else? If you go with somebody else, should it be a co-founder, an equal co-founder, or a junior co-founder? Or do you want to hire somebody? Based on our research and interviews, it can all work out. But what is critical is that if you go with somebody else, you basically make sure that you share the vision and the values. Mm. Because if you don't, you're going to run into trouble extremely fast.
One other place where you can run into trouble, you've used this phrase, the struggles of explosive growth, which sounds like a great problem to have, but is a problem nonetheless. What are some of the challenges that entrepreneurs face when it comes to growth?
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt about it. In fact, we say it's the struggles of growth or the struggles of explosive growth, because both are actually challenging for the entrepreneur. If you don't have growth, well, you've got to figure out how you're going to get on the growth curve. It comes down to execution, which sounds straightforward enough, but it's very challenging. You need to get on the growth curve and figure out what is going to drive your sales rapidly. In addition to that, you've got the grind and the chaos. And it's not that it's any one thing that may be challenging when you're looking at the operations, for example. It's what Josh Hicks referred to as, in his case, with his business, plated, when they deliver meal kits, and it's pre-portioned ingredients. And there's nothing inherently complex about selecting ingredients, chopping them up, putting them in a box, and shipping them to a customer. But doing it every week to tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of customers, and changing recipes week in and week out, managing that supply chain, managing the technology, having the staff, the hiring in place to actually fulfill the orders, that's what becomes challenging at scale. And this is what breaks. And a lot of entrepreneurs, you know, think it's very easy to do, but it's not. It's very complicated when you scale up.
The other part of that, and that's not to be underestimated, is that once growth kicks in, it becomes a different ballgame. And, you know, the grind and the chaos that Jim is talking about is very often a challenge for the team, because that's not what they were hired to do in the first place. So going from zero to one as a business is very different than going from one to 100 or 100 to 1,000, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
And that's a real challenge.
You talk about how the business model is not cast in iron. And we think about a company like GE, whose model has changed significantly over decades, even Amazon. Most people don't know about Amazon Web Services. Like, what? You make money on that? How do these entrepreneurs know that they need to shift, change, hop on a different horse?
Well, I think in the business model case, as we say, it's not cast in iron. And what we mean is you have got to anticipate, or if you don't anticipate what's around the corner, then you are going to be subjecting yourself to potential failure. So that's very, very important to see around the corner what may be coming that is either a threat to your business or, for that matter, an opportunity. It's very, very important. And now one of the aspects of this is, we talk about in the book how it's important to find your 2.0. And what we mean is you may have gotten to a certain level of growth, a certain tier of revenue, but you may max out and you need to figure out how are you getting to the next tier? How are you getting to your 2.0? So for example, Bespoke Post, who's in, we interviewed the founders, they grew to over $100 million in a subscription business for men's e-commerce. But it was capping out. They needed to find a new engine of growth. What is the 2.0? So they launched a satellite brand and designed a series of luggage products, which has been doing very, very well. It'll do another 30 million or more this year.
Wow.
So it's very important to figure out your 2.0 in order to propel that growth. And finally, last point I'd say is if you have to know when to pivot. And a pivot is required either, as we said, either to find an opportunity that is there that you hadn't thought about, or to fix a problem. And so pivoting is part and parcel for all founders' journeys.
You could summarize the reasons for pivoting around three themes. One is growth does not materialize or kind of levels off. That's one reason to pivot. Two is you've got a business model that doesn't work and you're never going to be profitable. So in today's environment, and I would even say brutal environment when it comes to fundraising, profitability has become much more important. So if you have no sight for profitability, you might want to think of a pivot. And then the third reason, and that's a big thing in our book as well, because everybody talked about it, is what we call the uncontrollables. You might do absolutely everything right, and then you wake up one morning and something happens, and an uncontrollable might be negative, but it might also be positive. Something happens. Think about COVID. I mean, how many businesses suffered from COVID? Some benefited, like Zoom, for example. I mean, that was a gift from God. But so you might do absolutely everything right, and then one day you get up and the environment has changed and you need to pivot, because otherwise you won't survive.
Really interesting stories in the book, lots of great examples, and I appreciate you both taking the time to talk to us about it today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Bruce.
The book is called Smart Startups, What Every Entrepreneur Needs to Know, Advice from 18 Harvard Business School Founders. Its authors, Catalina Daniels and James Sherman. Coming up next on Moolala, some of the different financial behaviors that may be holding you back from success. Money expert Jessica Morehouse is here to talk about them. And later, a platform called Checksy. It allows you to pay your rent with your credit card. We'll talk to its CEO to talk about how it works. If you are liking what you heard today, you can never miss an episode. Make sure you never, ever miss an episode. And here's how you can do that. Head over to moolala.ca. On that site, you can listen to past episodes, past segments. You can also search by keyword or guest name. Or you can go to any of the podcast platforms out there, Spotify, Amazon Prime, wherever else you listen to podcasts, and download any of the episodes, leave a review, subscribe, do all the things.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. Moolah La, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit. As I said, the counseling is free and judgment free. We are faced with about 35 million decisions every single day. Every single day, we are asked to make decisions on issues and questions, big and small, but so many when it comes to our personal finances. And frankly, as humans, we're not very good at doing that very often. And a part of this really dates back to, I don't know, the Paleozoic era when our brains began to form. And there are some real inefficiencies in how we think and behave and make decisions that we're going to take some time highlighting today. Our guest is money expert Jessica Morehouse. She's here to talk about some of the financial behaviors and a nod to behavioral economics and how we can optimize our own effectiveness when it comes to our money. Hello, Jessica.
Hello, I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you here. It's been a long time since we spoke.
I know.
I referenced Paleozoic times. Basically,
it wasn't that long ago.
It wasn't that long ago. But tell us a bit more about what we know about where these behaviors come mm-hmm. from, or these biases come from.
Yeah, so I think a lot of people don't realize, and once you start noticing it, you can notice it in everything that you do, but we all have certain behaviors or instincts, these impulses almost, to do a certain thing. And these behaviors were developed, in long ago times, Neanderthal times, the Stone Ages, and they were meant to help us survive because it was a lot more dangerous to live back then. And pretty much we were very easy to kill back then. And so we had to evolve and develop these behaviors to sense danger because it was pretty much everywhere. And unfortunately, even though now in 2023, we are much more evolved, we still have some of these behaviors. And instead of helping us survive, sometimes they do, sometimes we want those behaviors, but often they are actually leading us astray. They're leading us to make really bad decisions when it comes to lots of different parts of our lives. I know, we can totally attribute these to, your love life or friendships or your career, but also finances. And until you really recognize what's going on, you're just going to keep on repeating patterns.
I want to start with loss aversion. And I know this as something that people talk about as it relates to investing. Like you mm-hmm. bought this stock, and even though it's dropped 90% in value, you hold on to it with this deluded fantasy that one day it's going to rebound. What are some other areas in which people might find resonance in that idea of loss aversion?
Yeah, so loss aversion is really interesting because when you think about it, it's pretty simple. But again, why do we keep on repeating these patterns that are hurting us? You mentioned the really common example of, investing in a stock and then you see it go down. And what do? You panic because you don't want to lose more of your money. And so you sell it at a loss. Whereas if you maybe just kept it and maybe it would rebound or even gain, you'd actually be better off for it. So why are we doing these things now? For some different examples, I think I just saw online that there's some big sale on some big website that I will not name of that always has a big sale. And it's the idea of like, I don't want to lose my chance, kind of that FOMO a little bit. And so, you're like, if I don't spend money, I'm going to lose money. And so there's a lot of things that are marketed to us in a way that if you don't take advantage now, you're going to regret it. You're going to lose something. And we, loss aversion really is based on the fact that we want to survive more than thrive. Even though we think about, oh yeah, of course we want to thrive. No, we want to survive first, and we will sacrifice thriving. So holding on to that stock so it could grow and help us retire one day, we would much rather do something safe. We're seeing a lot of this right now with high interest rates. People are selling off their investments, getting into GICs. And you're like, yeah, that makes sense, I guess, in the short term, but long term, that is a terrible idea. But people are afraid of losing everything. And so they're making decisions based off that fear.
It's like the call now, don't wait. The infomercials of the 80s that manifest very clearly in the social media age too. I want to ask you about herd mentality. There, yeah, I'm sure, are many ways in which herd mentality saves us, because someone in the herd saw a wolf. And we're now all running from that very clear and present danger, the wolf, but sometimes there is not a wolf at the door.
No, I mean, this is a behavior that it's good that we still have it for certain things like survival. I mean, if you are in a situation where you're in a war zone and you see a bunch of people running, it's probably because there's danger. Maybe there's some bombs or something like that. Or I've even seen some things online where people think that there's danger. And, you know, they see a couple of people running and then everyone gets up and they run and then they find out, oh, no, it's a running group or something like that. So that's not really helpful. But in certain circumstances, it can save your life. But when it comes to your money, again, you're following the crowd, but you're maybe not taking that time to be like, wait, why are they running? Where are they running to? Maybe I should do some more, you know, thoughtful analysis. And so herd mentality, we saw a lot of this going on. I want to say specifically 2020, 2022, when people were really into the meme stock situation, cryptocurrency, NFTs. I mean, no one is talking about NFTs, but for a while, I almost felt like, is this the future? Because everyone's talking about it. And so you don't want to be the last person, you don't want to be that person who doesn't, progress with everybody. You want to make sure that we're keeping up with each other, because that is, again, how you survive. But again, if you just follow the herd and don't take a minute to kind of regulate your emotions and take some time to think about what's actually going on here, you were going to buy an NFT for $10,000 that's worth $0 now, you know? Yeah. And we don't want to be in that situation. And so that's something that you have to be very focused on. That's something that really comes with time. Like, even for me, I know all this stuff. And when all that was happening, I even felt this like inertia that I should do something. Or like one example too is, you know, when Taylor Swift doing some tickets on sale in Toronto, I'm like, should I buy tickets? Everyone's talking about it. I don't want to be left out. And I'm like, I haven't actually listened to her music in years, but I felt like I had to keep up with my peers.
Confirmation bias is the third. And, you know, I think most of us love to be right. Like, we just love to be right. And this can get us into trouble.
Yeah. I mean, again, we saw a lot of this in the past couple of years with the chaos that was COVID and the U.S. politics, all the elections that were happening in the U.S. and Canada, and people like information that confirms what they already believe and they know. And so, I mean, I remember seeing a lot of conversations, you know, online, on Reddit, especially about, you know, like COVID and vaccines, like, is it good? Is it bad? And people would find all this evidence to be like, no, this is why the vaccine is going to help us. And so many people would find just as much information to say the opposite. And so it's not like they were actually like having a conversation, be like, maybe I should consider a different point of view. We're just going to double down and look for stuff that already confirms what we believe because it makes us feel good. You know what doesn't feel good is someone saying that you're wrong. You don't want to be wrong. You want to be right. So you're going to find evidence to prove that you were right, even if it's digging yourself into a deeper and deeper hole that you cannot get out of later.
So we have a theoretical understanding of these three biases or financial behaviors that date back forever.
Yeah.
What do you do about it? Like, what do you put them on post-it notes on your phone before you buy something on Etsy? How do you make it useful? How do you make this wisdom, this insight useful?
Yeah, well, I'd say I'd almost want to bring up another bias to answer that question, which is called status quo bias. It is the feeling that we are so resistant to change or doing something different, doing something new. And so, you know, I've done a lot of research for my book about this. This is going to be part of a chapter I'm working on. And what's so funny is like trying to find the solutions to these biases it's very simple, but it's so it's kind of like almost anything in personal finance. You probably know this. It's like the it's not that hard to budget, to pay off debt, you know, to actually understand the strategies out there, the practical how to's. It's actually doing it. And with status quo bias, we're so resistant to anything new, because again, back in the day, anything new could be a potential danger or hazard. And I see that with a lot of just in the financial sphere. There's a lot of, you know, new fintech, a lot of new innovation in the field. And we are so, and people are still afraid. I mean, my mother-in-law still does checks. She doesn't do online banking. And it's, she's not that old, what? You know? She does, wow. She's in her 60s. That is too young to be afraid of the internet. Or, you know, I see this even with young people afraid to try different apps, you know, as one example. Actually, I was helping my husband. He was trying to figure out a way for his business. He'd been doing the same thing for a long time, as we all do. And he, you know, works with clients internationally. He's a, you know, works with musicians. He's trying to figure out how to get paid, how not to pay a lot of money in fees, you know, with like a PayPal or whatever. And it took a while for us to find something. We found this app called Wise that makes it really easy to kind of transfer money internationally, low fees, all that kind of stuff. And now he's using it and he's loving it. But it was hard for him to actually, like, it took him a while. I'm like, I made an account. I tested it out. I had all this evidence to prove, like, hey, you should try. It took him a while to, like, months to open an account and try it himself, because he was so afraid of something new and different. Even though, like, when you look at it, it's like, it's not that crazy complicated. It's right. Not really a new concept. It's just a new product, a new service. It's, you know, but we are just terrified of making a mistake. And so we're more comfortable sticking with what we know, even though we could be losing out on, you know, potential investment gains. We could be paying more in fees if we're sticking with a certain product instead of like, oh, or you could do that. Like, I saw a lot of that with, you know, investing. People still like their high fee mutual funds. And you're like, but you know, there's other options out there.
Right.
Same thing, lower fees. You could be spending, you know, or saving rather thousands of dollars a year just by switching to a different product. But people are just like, I can't do it.
Well, we have provided them with a prompt and some insight and a nudge.
Yeah.
I think we've nudged them. Jessica, thank you for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jessica Morehouse is a money expert, podcast host, knower of all things, and she's working on a new book coming out sometime in, I don't know, 2025 or something.
2025.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Coming up later, using your credit card to pay rent. There's this new service called Checksy, and its CEO, Lisa Akvledziani, will tell us how it works. But first, why more Canadians are taking side hustles. Anurag Kaur from Interact takes us through its recent survey and a learning hub with tools and resources for entrepreneurs. If you'd like the latest and greatest that Moolala has to offer, don't miss an episode by tuning into or by signing up for our newsletter. You'll see all the fun stuff. At least I think it's fun stuff we've done on CBC Radio and CityLine here on SiriusXM, plus tips and tricks to help you get a handle on your money.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
A recent survey from Interact looked into some of the reasons why more and more Canadians are taking on side hustles. Now, many do this, lots of different reasons, we're going to talk about them, but they feel like they're lacking the tools and the advice that they need to grow the business once they start that. So to deal with that, or some help with that, Interact created something called From Dollar One. So we're going to talk about the survey. We're going to talk about From Dollar One with Anurag Kaur. He is the AVP of Money Movement Products at Interact. Hello there.
Hey, Bruce. Thanks for having me on.
What is a money movement product? Did you make that up? Did you just throw a couple of random words together and call that your new title?
Well, of course. The company lets me just decide what I can pick as my tagline, and that's what I came up with. That's the best I could do.
What is a money movement product?
Our money movement products on the Interact side are products such as Interact e-Transfer. We have some international payment capabilities and some corporate payables and receivables products. So any product that we provide that essentially allows one of our financial institutions to allow their consumers to send money or receive money is a money movement product.
Oh my God. I'm sure your Zoom meetings are filled with all sorts of exercises and things like that with music, I hope. I hope that's
exactly it. We like to keep it easy.
Of course you do. I want to talk about the survey results. I hate surveys by and large, but when I read this one, I thought, oh, there's something interesting here. The reason I hate them, by the way, is I find so often they're just marketing rah, 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 that don't actually provide any insight to people. This one I thought was interesting. Tell us what stood out for you on the topic of side hustles.
Yeah. So recently we just did a survey just asking Canadians, you know, on what are the things that they're doing beyond their regular 9-to-5 job to make a living, to make some earning outside of their normal day job. And what we found was nearly half of Canadian entrepreneurs that we polled, about 46% of them, increasing numbers of them have been starting side hustles in the past year. 4 in 10 of the individuals that we surveyed, they're actually currently considering one additional idea for a new venture. So what's become very apparent is a lot of Canadians, about 37% of entrepreneurs, they actually cited earning additional income as a top reason for doing their side hustle. But almost half of those respondents, they said they do it out of necessities. So side hustles have become this part of the Canadian culture where it's more than your day job. You wanted to do it for your passion and you do it out of necessity.
Yeah. Inflation, interest rates, still coming out of COVID, it's brutal for people to find ways to make ends meet. What else did you learn?
Yeah. So the other interesting fact that we learned was 9 to 5. It's a line that, you know, we like to say for individuals who are doing their side hustle. And nearly 6 in 10 respondents, 55% of them, say that their side hustle actually turned out to be more fulfilling than expected. You know, they really start off out of an idea or necessity, but about 55% of them are doing this and they like it more than their day job. And 3/4 of them, they continue their side hustle alongside their main job. So they take on the stress of 2 jobs, where 2 in 10 of them plan to go all in. They want to turn that side hustle and passion project into their careers.
Are you looking to see if Dolly Parton is willing to change the lyrics to her seminal song? And then you could use it in all of your marketing. Is that priority number one for you?
I think that's what the Interact marketing team has said. They said Dolly Parton number one.
9 to 5. I think that is one of the cheesiest sayings I've ever heard. And I also kind of like it. But
that's
like
awesome.
Like cheese whiz, I like. So there are challenges that people face, right? Many of them. What's this From Dollar One thing provide?
Yeah. So as part of the survey, what we learned was a lot of the individuals who are starting these side hustles, they essentially are lacking the financial confidence at getting up and going. So what we discovered very quickly was, you know, the realities of opening up a business or a side hustle comes to fruition when someone has to worry about making the first, you know, payment, receiving it, paying staff eventually, going and turning a profit. So what we did was we launched a resource for Canadians called From Dollar One, where we actually take our learnings and understandings of the business and how one of the key Canadian financial services, such as Interact e-Transfer, actually becomes a critical part of every entrepreneur's side hustle. And what we wanted to do was provide the tools for their, you know, financial confidence, to increase the financial literacy as they're growing their side hustles.
Can you give us some examples of the content on From Dollar One?
100%. So the content really focuses on the payment side of things. So it talks about the different payment methods, what are the pros and cons from a cost perspective, or what can happen when, let's say, you know, there's some bad activity that happens with the payment. And then the content also goes into the different payment options in the market where they can either pay really quickly or get paid fast versus if time is not of the essence and they have a little bit more time to receive money or pay someone, what are some of the payment options? And the last piece is it provides them with some context on how to stay in charge of their small business. You know, simple things such as paying attention to their vendor agreements, the payment terms to avoid the late payment fees and penalties, just basic business advice as everyone's just worried about getting their side hustle growing.
Most of us are used to using plastic for everything, and plastic can be credit card, can be a debit card, as well. One of the things that I noticed is on e-transfers is the fees aren't always the same. How does a someone with a side hustle or an entrepreneur think about fee parity when it comes to questions their clients might have about why does it cost me 50 cents here and a buck here?
Yeah, all the time, our main messaging when it comes to fees is check with your financial institution. They are the ones who set the fees for the service. We're a wholesale provider to financial institutions. So our advice would always be check with your financial institution. Depending on the accounting or the banking package that the individual is on, the fees can naturally change. And also do your research. There are many financial institutions who actually provide Iraqi transfer for free. So when it's a business who's running a side hustle and is receiving money, a lot of the times that the customers are paying them, they must have e-transfer for free. Versus if there is a customer who doesn't have it for free, our recommendation would always be shop around, look at the different banking packages, and use the financial institution that meets your needs the best.
That was a total cop-out answer. It was like, talk to your father about that. Okay, now I don't know if you've done this story on From Dollar One. If you haven't, you should. And that is around how to talk to an employer about a side hustle. Have you pursued insight on that front? Because I can imagine for a lot of employers and for employees trying to figure out what works as a side hustle that isn't that doesn't take away from the job that pays most of my rent.
Yeah, so we haven't delved too much into the details on the employer side when someone is doing a side hustle and, you know, has a traditional 9-to-5 job as well. But that's going to be in our future iterations. But one of the advices that we've had is always for entrepreneurs to look out for what their main source of income is. If the side hustle does become the main source of income, then your energy and your focus should be on that. Whereas, you know, your 9-to-5 job might not be of the single most importance. Compared to if the side hustle is very new and it's in the early stages, well, your employer and your attention to your 9-to-5 job is very critical. And so we've always advised that look out for your main sources of income and then balance your efforts according to it.
I want to guess your side hustle. I have two guesses. My first guess is wedding DJ, and my second is merchandiser of t-shirts with the logos of early 90s bands. How close am I?
You are not close at all. I love walking dogs. Just because you loved dogs.
Okay.
Eh?
Genius. Okay.
Something simple.
And do you, well, I know what your answer is going to be. Do you accept payment on Interact e-transfer?
100%. That's the only way I collect the payment.
God, I love it. Anurag, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Bruce, for having me.
Anurag Kaur is AVP Money Movement Products. I hope he gets teased mercilessly for such a ridiculous job title, because it's ridiculous, and I teased him already for that. Stay with us. Coming up, would you use your credit card to pay rent? Not what we've got Interact on the phone. They should be an e-transfer, but there is this platform. It's called Checksy, and it allows you to pay your rent on your credit card, and they say helps build your credit score too. The CEO of the company will be here. If you are looking for some books to help you with personal finance, I have written a couple myself, available anywhere books are sold. The first one is called Moolala, Why Smart People Do Dumb Things With Their Money and What You Can Do About It.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
We use our credit cards for a lot these days. In fact, like literally almost everything, you can slap down your plastic and be done with it. Now, you have the option of paying your rent with your credit card, which probably seemed unimaginable a couple of years ago. It is now possible, and we're going to talk about one way to do that. It is a platform called Checksy. It also lets you earn rewards, which, you know, that isn't new. Canadians are nuts about rewards. We're going to talk about how it works for both renters and for landlords. And to do that, we're joined by Checksy's CEO, Lisa Akvledziani. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
Why would someone want to pay their rent with their credit card?
That's a great question. And actually, I fit the bill perfectly as an example here. I've been a renter in Canada for the last 10 years, and I've paid rent primarily with posted checks. And I started Checksy specifically because during COVID and my last rental, my landlord wouldn't even show me the unit in person, but she insisted I hand deliver her 12 posted checks still. And I just had this question is, you know, I use my credit card, like you said, for everything. Rent is my biggest expense. I would like to be able to earn those rewards or that cash back on that expense. Why can't I do that? And that is kind of what started Checksy. And I would say the main reason for why people want to use credit cards for rent is to finally get something back from, you know, that largest and ever growing, it seems like, expense.
When you say get something back, what do you mean?
So, you know, depending on the card you're using, obviously you're used to earning, whether it's rewards, you know, with your American Express or other rewards credit cards, or your cash back, depending on the type of card. Now you're able, by paying rent with credit card, essentially extend that to your largest chunk of spending. So kind of in many cases, double or triple the rewards that you're earning on that card every single month.
And how did you make this happen? Because, you know, for you to pay with a credit card at any merchant, they typically have to sign on and become a merchant of that card. And there's a whole bunch of things that they need to do. Not every landlord is going to be willing to do that. So how does this work in your case?
And that is a great question. That is one of the reasons that currently most consumers can't pay with credit card, because like you said, the landlord doesn't want to do the legwork. There's really very little benefit to them. So why would they ever bother? What Checksy did is we essentially became the merchant acquirer for those landlords by enabling our service. So now the landlord doesn't actually have to do any of the legwork. The way that our platform works is when a tenant signs up and decides they want to pay, as long as their landlord is okay receiving an e-transfer, the tenant pays us and we process that payment and send their landlord an e-transfer. So the whole idea of my landlord doesn't need to sign up or onboard is actually been one of the biggest reasons for our growth and one of the probably most attractive things of our platform.
And there's a fee associated with that. Tell us how that fee works.
Absolutely. So we charge a 1.75% fee to the tenant. And, you know, if you at all are aware of this, and I would say most consumers probably aren't, that is very typical because we have fees to pay to interchange as well as network fees to Visa, MasterCard, and American Express. And anytime that you pay with your credit card at SOAR, the merchant pays that fee. With rent, obviously, the way that we do it, we keep that fee specifically really low, taking advantage of some rent-specific programs with Visa and MasterCard, and try to enable our consumers to still earn net rewards on top of that fee. So with many cards in the market, you can earn, you know, 4-3% cashback on recurring bills, which rent qualifies at. So even though you're paying 1.75% to us, you're getting 4% back from whoever your card is. It's a pretty good bargain. And on an average $2,500 rent in Toronto, you could be, you know, netting positive $60 a month, which is not an insignificant amount for people.
I think it is important to illustrate that a consumer is going to be paying that fee, given that the benefits really need to exceed it. Because I think my cashback card pays 2%. Maybe I'm getting a terrible deal. So in my case, it would be a wash. It wouldn't be financially worth it to do that the way the funds would flow through.
Yeah, 100%. It's not right for every card. And I would say our service is probably not the right service for every single renter out there. And we're very transparent about that. I think we are a great service for people who are, you know, financially savvy and sophisticated, who are going to use the credit card and pay it off essentially right after they paid their rent. So they never carry over a balance or overstretch themselves financially or start getting interest charges. Like, there is no interest for Chexy to take advantage of people to do that. So I would say our general consumer and kind of the people that are mostly attracted to our product are those very financially savvy renters, young professionals in downtown Toronto, downtown Vancouver, who are paying $3,000 and up in rent and have a good Amex, and they're going to take advantage of those rewards.
One of the other things you talk about is the benefit of enabling you to build your credit score, demonstrate solid credit behavior by using your platform. How does that work?
Absolutely. So I would say that's one of the biggest attractions for a newcomer to use our product. And I should say that to build credit on rent through Chexy, you don't have to use a credit card. You can use your bank account and there's no fee associated with that. And you just pay for the credit builder subscription. The reason I think it's very topical right now is because so many newcomers are coming to the country. I was a newcomer myself. I came to Canada in 2014. Rent has been my largest expense for the last 10 years. It never helped me build credit. And it can really be an uphill journey and a battle for a lot of people, as well as people who are in Canada who have maybe made a mistake in the past financially and are trying to recover that credit. Ultimately, renting is becoming more and more competitive. People are, you know, paying so much more. Why shouldn't rent be something that does help you build your financial future?
There's another product there on the out there on the market from Borrowell. I think it's called Rent Advantage. How does your approach, how is it similar to or different from that one?
That's a great question. Actually, very close friends with some of the founders of Borrowell. I think they've done an incredible job with their business. The biggest difference is we are a payments company, so we require people to pay rent with us, and we actually enable your convenience of paying rent, roommate splitting, as well as all the additional features around rewards and credit building, versus Borrowell is more of a, you know, data aggregator and a reporting company. So they don't require and don't provide any payment services. They just tell you, hey, we're going to scrape your bank account and essentially report that payment to credit bureaus. So that's the biggest difference.
What should people expect in terms of the lift on their credit score from having rent as a line item in whatever way they do that? Is that like an amazing move for someone who's got a credit score of, you know, 580, but kind of irrelevant for someone who's got a credit score of 810?
Yes. So I will be very careful here because I show my friends at Equifax and they're going to be happy with any misinformation. I will say that it is very situational. For someone, like you said, with a lower than 600 credit score, or someone who doesn't have a lot of line items on their credit report, like a newcomer, reporting a big payment, given that payments contribute to 35% of your credit score, can be a very significant lift. Now, of course, for someone who, like you said, has a 750 or an 800 credit score, has three accounts, two lines of credit, a car loan, you know, it's probably not going to be as big of an impact. So this product specifically on the credit building side specifically targets those people that are actively thinking about building or rebuilding their credit and have otherwise what is called by, you know, Equifax and credit agencies, a thin file. So they don't have a lot of other payments that are contributing to that credit report.
We talk about Canadians' obsession with rewards, and we know this by data, we know this by anecdote. When you talk about the rewards that a Chexy client accumulates, is it with their primary card, or are we getting free donuts from you directly?
So there is actually two way. Number one is with their primary card. And then the second way, we have what we call a rent cashback program, where if you shop with any of our partner brands, which include brands like Under Armour, Apple, Walmart, through our affiliate links, you get to earn cashback on those purchases in addition to whatever cashback you earn on your card with us. And that cashback you can accumulate over time and it can help you redeem rent. So let's say, for example, you know, in a month of September, you're buying your summer son or yourself a new laptop to go to school, you spend $2,000 because can you believe it or not, that's how much laptops cost these days at Apple, you know, with a 2% rent cashback, you could be benefiting that amount back with Checksy and using that to pay rent next month.
We know from a behavior standpoint that Canadians will do everything they possibly can to pay to keep a roof over their head, their rent, their mortgage, whatever. They are less ruthless about paying their credit card off in full every single month. And many people fall prey to things that they're excited to buy, even if they can't pay that credit card off in full every month. Does Checksy muddy the waters? Because now what was a sacred amount that I was going to pay no matter what is lumped in with, ooh, you know, I hit the mall on the weekend, and now it's just an amount that is a part of a bigger ephemeral amount.
That's great. That's a great question. And I don't believe we muddy the waters. Again, because of the fee that we charge and because we're very transparent that it is worth for some credit cards and not worth for the others, the like average client that we tend to have is pretty financially sophisticated and carries really little balance over. Now, is this, of course, a product that someone who maybe is not as financially sophisticated can, you know, fall into trap by using? Potentially. But in the end of the day, one of the things that I guess we benefit from is that, you know, some people say, oh, you know, if you can allow someone to pay rent with credit cards, they're going to go and overstretch themselves and get a place they can't really afford. And that's not true, because we know that the landlords who they're applying to, you know, they're not going to care how you're paying rent. They will underwrite you based on how much money you make and, you know, whether or not you can afford that place. So in the end of the day, we're just a payment service. You know, we're a payment service that I think makes sense for some people. Hopefully, as we continue rolling out our features, makes up for even more people. But I don't believe that, you know, we're responsible for someone who is potentially using that to their own detriment.
Interesting. Lisa, thank you for your time today and for like a new interesting way to think about how we spend our money every month. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Bruce. Pleasure speaking.
Lisa Akflaziani is the CEO of Checksy, interesting platform that includes, not the only thing, but includes the ability for you to pay your rent with your credit card. That's it for our show today. A thank you to our sponsors, Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. If you have a comment, a question, a story idea, feedback, or just want to, I don't know, share your personal finance tip of the day, send us an email to ask@moolala.ca. ask@moolala.ca. You can also sign up for the newsletter that is at moolala.ca, and we will make sure that we never send you anything other than the news of Moolala, and we do that once a month. On social media, I am at Bruce Celery on X, formerly Twitter, and Bruce Celery Moolala on Facebook. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.